Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Samson Mao, who is the outgoing Chief Strategy Officer of Blockstream and the CEO of gaming company Pixelmatic. Samson has been in the Bitcoin space for several years, and he's got some unique experiences and unique insights, and I look forward to chatting with him about many topics in which he has been involved. He's helped Blockstream launch many of their products and initiatives. And he's also been involved with El Salvador's issuance of the Volcano Bond and the development of the Bitcoin City. Samson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Saifeddin.
So let's first of all begin with you and your background. How did you get into Bitcoin, and what got you into Blockstream, and what got you into all of this world?
Right. So it's quite a while ago. I was previously the COO at BTC China, or BTCC, known in the West. And it was one of the biggest Bitcoin exchanges and mining pools in the world. It was the exchange that everyone went to after Mt. Gox was hacked. So there was a period of explosive growth where it was the biggest in the world. And then the mining pool, which launched, I think, in 2016, it grew to about 20% of network hash rate at the peak. So that was my original entry point into the Bitcoin world formally. And I met Adam Back during the scaling wars, which I think we're going to talk a bit about today. And I got to know him and know what Blockstream's mission was. So Blockstream was founded in 2014. to extend Bitcoin technology through sidechains and also second layer technologies like Lightning. But I thought it was interesting to move into Bitcoin infrastructure development and work with Blockstream. So I left BTC China and then I joined Blockstream in 2017.
Yeah, and so tell us a little bit more about Blockstream. What is it that Blockstream does?
Right, so Blockstream was founded based on the sidechains white paper. And I guess you could say the mission of Blockstream is to augment Bitcoin. So there's a number of products and projects at Blockstream that do that. The most famous one is probably the Blockstream satellite network. So it's a network of satellites in geosynchronous orbit that are broadcasting the Bitcoin blockchain all around the globe. But we have wallets as well, Blockstream Green. Blockstream also does mining. So that was something I kicked off after I joined in 2017. So we started mining in Canada and then later expanded to the US. And of course, work on the Bitcoin protocol itself and the Lightning Network and the Liquid Network.
The Liquid Network is one of the most interesting things perhaps happening at Blockstream. What is the Liquid Network and what does it do?
Right. So the Liquid Network is a Bitcoin sidechain. A sidechain is simply another blockchain that's anchored to Bitcoin. And in my definition of a sidechain does not have its own native token or currency. It would just use Bitcoin, just like you use Bitcoin in the Lightning Network when you open the Lightning channel. So you end up locking Bitcoin on the main chain and unlocking it in the sidechain. And that gives you new capabilities and new properties. So there's always a one-to-one relationship between Bitcoin and Liquid Bitcoin. But Liquid Bitcoin is faster because there are one-minute block times. And you also have the benefit of confidential transactions, which I think in today's world, we're seeing that is becoming more and more important and necessary. The other thing about Liquid is you can issue tokens. So the base currency of Liquid is still Bitcoin, but you can create assets in the network, like stable coins such as USDT. There's a JPY stablecoin that's done out of Japan through our partner Crypto Garage. You have LCAD from Bull Bitcoin, Canadian dollar stablecoin. And you can do things like securities. So if you use a Blockstream product called AMP, Blockstream AMP, you can create tokens that have the same net effect as something like a smart contract on one of those shitcoin chains. So there's a policy server that is managing these tokens, which are signed in a 2-of-2 format. So the policy server will see if you're an accredited investor or qualified investor, which is managed through a whitelist by a company. And then if you are on that list, it'll let you sign off and send the transaction to another person. So in effect, you can do securities. You can do things like the Volcano Bond. We have at Blockstream, there's a Blockstream mining note, BMN token, which is tokenization and securitization of Blockstream's hash rate. And also Pixelmatic is doing a game called Infinite Fleet, which has XO token from the publisher, which is also a security. So it's a way to do securities and permissioned or tracked assets on a blockchain. And the beautiful thing is all of these assets in Liquid are confidential. So when I make a transaction in Liquid, you don't know if I'm sending Liquid Bitcoin or USDT or a Volcano Bond. So it's a really interesting technology, I think, that is not paid that much attention to because there's no native token involved. So it's all about the tech.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you look at with the majority of shitcoin technologies out there, it seems like the, you know, the if you spend some time looking into them, you start realizing that the story about the kind of utility that is being offered from the shitcoin chain is really a fig leaf to cover up the fact that they're just issuing a security, really. And it's, and I think, I mean, this is something that I'd always thought they're just issuing Ponzi schemes. But I think Michael Saylor's clarity on clarifying that all of this stuff is just securities. And I'm not very familiar with securities law, so this is not something that occurred to me earlier. But after Michael Saylor, and you know, when we hosted him here in this podcast and we had him, in the second or third time that we had him here, we've had him three times so far. In the third time, we discussed these And he makes a pretty compelling case that these are basically unregistered securities, and the reason that there has been such a huge market in altcoins is because they are a way to offer unregistered securities. So the hype seems to be about the unregistered securities, but there's little utility behind there. I mean, I think there's nothing really that shitcoins do that is really different from what Bitcoin does. And I think with Liquid, that probably disappears entirely. And it seems like you can get all of the functionality of anything that you want, but Liquid makes it straightforward. You know, there's no security there. The Liquid network itself is just pegged to Bitcoin, if I understand correctly, so that you can't speculate on the Liquid token. The Liquid token is always worth one Bitcoin, right? But it has potential for offering stable coins and offering many of the other securities, but to do them in a way that is regulated, right?
Yeah. So I think you're right about the most shitcoins being securities or unregistered securities, and also the smart contracting, theme or messaging for the shitcoins also. It is a way for them to obfuscate what they're doing too. Because if you look at a smart contract, all you really care about is the end result of that smart contract. So you have to rely on some external thing like a price oracle or some input that says the contract has been fulfilled. And all that really matters at the end is the output, right? It's either you pay or you don't pay. And you can do that with Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin does have smart contracts, but that's largely ignored because it's not part of the shitcoin narrative. But it's the same for doing a security on Liquid. At the end of the day, you know, can you transact it or does it pay out? That is all determined by a centralized structure in some place. So you can have all this decentralization theater. And exactly. You can have as complex a smart contract as you like on, you know, as convoluted and hand-wavy blockchain technology as you like. But at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is pay or don't pay, right? And that's determined by inputs from an external party. It's not determined by the chain itself. So you just need something like Liquid and a policy server, which is not on the chain, of course, but it is scalable. It doesn't make sense that you would insert a copy of every single contract into every single node, because at that point it becomes centralized. Right? Nobody can run that node and nobody can verify anything. You just end up calling an API on Infura, which is on Amazon, which makes it pointless.
Absolutely. This is, I think, something that I've been writing about. Before I wrote the Bitcoin Standard, I made my name because I wrote an article saying blockchain technology is only good for Bitcoin. Everything else is pretty much a waste of time. And I've this was the idea that if you're going to be looking at, if you're going to be putting anything on a blockchain, and if it's going to actually be useful as a blockchain, it needs to be decentralized. So you need to, and if it's actually really decentralized, not decentralization theater, as is the case with most shitcoins that essentially just have basically a few people in charge and then everybody's running their node on centralized infrastructure, then you have an enormous computing load that is being distributed. You know, why do we need to have tens of thousands of computers registering real estate deeds or stocks or securities or whatever? There's no need for all of that stuff, because ultimately the only person that matters, say in the case of real estate, is the local, the local police. They're the ones that are going to come and kick you out of the house if it's not your house. You know, that's the only node that really matters. There's a local police. They have the guns. And if they have a piece of paper or a digital record that says, this is your house, then if I show up and I say, this is my house, they'll come and they'll kick me out and it'll be your house. And it doesn't matter what a million other nodes have to say. So you're adding computation on many, many computers in a way that it doesn't really add any value, because ultimately, the thing that you're looking at, whether it's real estate or stocks, it is itself centralized. So the house is a centralized single point of failure. There needs, you know, there's a police in that area, and that police controls it. So you're already going with a trusted third party. And distributing the ownership of the house over thousands of nodes doesn't give you any benefits added to that. It just adds computation. So there's no logical reason for why this would take off. And that's why we see, you know, we've had so many use cases being offered for why you want to use a blockchain over the years. And, you know, on Twitter, we've had all of the noobs come to us and tell us, ha, 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 you think Bitcoin is only a useful blockchain? Well, what about real estate in India? You know, what's this guy's name? The famous shitcoiner, Ari David Paul. What about blackjack, you know, playing blackjack distributed in real estate in India? And they've been saying this stuff for what, 4 or 5 years now, and never comes to fruition. We don't see real estate in India being put on a blockchain for a very good reason. And of course, you know, the pitch is, look, real estate records in India are so bad, then blockchain fixes it. Well, no, there are a lot of bad things in the world that blockchain can't fix. So it, in many cases, it is decentralization theater, I think in the majority of cases. Perhaps the one exception might be, and I'm recently beginning to really think this might be the one exception, is stablecoins. I think they are, to an extent, centralized. And I think I'm surprised that governments haven't shut them down. I think if I were to revise what I said about blockchains, I, you know, logically, it makes sense to me that governments would shut down stable coins. And Michael Saylor seems to suggest that they likely will shut them down. And that, you know, they're not going to let random companies issue those stable coins. They're going to let, they're going to have JP Morgan and these big established regulated banks issue them. And I think there's another case to be made, which I also argued about with Saylor, which is that maybe, you know, why JP Morgan? Why not just have the Fed issue the central, issue these stable coins themselves? So I'm curious, what do you think about stable coins as they exist right now and as they are on Liquid, and where you see this space going in the next few years?
Yeah, so I think my thesis is very similar to yours, that blockchain technology is really only good for financial assets. You could possibly do real estate, but you need a very robust system to do that, right? You need something, basically some random guy can't do it. You need someone that has the know-how, the technological capability, and the security processes in place, like almost like a stablecoin issuer, right? You can't just have some random company go and do it. You need something bigger, right? Creating securities does make sense. There are benefits to be gained from using quote unquote blockchain technology, right? If you have things like stablecoins, securities on a chain, you can get a lot more trading over time. You can also have peer-to-peer trading as well. So for example, the BMN token from Blockstream, it's not listed on any exchange right now, but people are trading it in a Telegram group because it is on the Liquid chain, and they can do that. They, as long as they're both whitelisted, they can trade it freely. For things like stablecoins, right? They just don't stop; they keep going 24/7. For things like Volcano bonds or anything like that, those can follow the same principle. So you can get a lot more utility out of these things when they are on a blockchain. And like that blockchain, it could be a sidechain like Liquid, right? Liquid is a federation. The blocks are assigned by 15 federation members. There's no excess amount of electricity consumed. It's probably the same as a fridge or a small fridge for a year, right? So when you have things like that decentralization theater for all the shitcoins, that is actually wasteful, right? You're doing proof of work just to pretend to be doing something decentralized when actually you could get rid of all that and just have one guy running that one node on Infura that everyone calls, right? And that is largely what the networks are for these guys. Because when Infura goes down or Amazon goes down, then everything shuts down. All the exchanges halt deposits. You just have to look carefully at what's going on and you understand how incredibly centralized it all is. To the other point about stablecoins, I think a few years back, I said stablecoins are a mid-step towards hyper-Bitcoinization. So eventually we won't need stable coins. And I think that you're right, that governments will shut them down eventually. It's just a matter of when. And I don't think that they'll get like JP Morgan or Chase to do them. they'll just go directly to the source, right? Just have the central bank issue them. Why have a middleman, right? They can collect all the data. They can monitor all transactions. And you don't have to deal with a bank getting in the way, because you'd actually need to do something like get a court order to get data from a bank. But if the central bank is the issuer, they have all the data already, right? They can freeze every transaction if they wanted to. And we kind of got a feel for that in Canada, right? So, you know, if you didn't like a bank freezing your account, then you're definitely not going to like the central bank freezing your account, because that's even easier and closer to government control than the banks themselves. But there is a use case for stablecoins right now. So if you're in an emerging market and you have suppliers and you're paying your suppliers still in fiat currencies, everything is denominated in fiat dollars or whatever, stablecoin is useful. And stablecoins are, they have similar properties to Bitcoin, even though they're centralized, which is you can move them permissionlessly. And, you know, largely, if a stablecoin, like let's say USDT, is out in the wild, then a normal average person could just get a wallet and get that stablecoin without having to go to an exchange, right? And there is a lot of value in that. If you think about it, even if JP Morgan or Chase wanted to do stablecoins and give them to people, they still would not give them to an unbanked guy with no address or, you know, identification, right? That you're going to get to the same problem of would you give them a bank account, a proper bank account? And the answer is no. So the only way that the underprivileged or unbanked or, you know, people less fortunate have is to use a stablecoin. And I think if a government shuts that down, then it's largely going to impact probably the less fortunate people than the people that have the means to get a bank account.
I'm curious why you say that. I think you know, there's a, if you're the central bank of the U.S., if you're the Federal Reserve, you know, if Tether and Bitfinex can get a stablecoin to run, and they can get it to run securely enough that somebody in Lebanon or Venezuela can use it and trade with it, and you know, it works. It works well enough for them. It works much better than their local bank account. Why wouldn't they just do that? Why would they need to make it so that it is? You need to have a banking license essentially to, or you need to have KYC. I don't see why they'd want KYC on that beyond surveillance, which they can implement anyway. So I mean, I think they let the coins run, and you know, the more people use the dollar, the more people use the stable coin, the more demand there is for it, and the more they can benefit from inflating the supply. You want more users. So I see it as, I mean, this is the trend that has been in capital markets for the last 50 years, which is all of the world's currencies are eager to collapse next to the dollar, because who, you know, why would you want to hold any currency other than the US dollar? If you had a choice, everybody would choose the dollar. The dollar is more liquid. With money, everybody wants to prefers the thing that is the most liquid. The limit on why people can't just hold dollars is because they have local central banks, and the local central banks force them to use their local currencies. But wouldn't stablecoins be a way for the central bank of the U.S. to basically run around all of the local central banks?
I think it has more to do with regulatory pressure. So if a bank is the issuer of a stablecoin, and anybody, like let's say someone in a sanctioned country, could access that stablecoin, then you know, they would get an immense amount of pressure to do something about that, right? Or even societal pressures. Like, let's say you have an OnlyFans page or something like that, and you live in a country that doesn't like that. They would put pressure on that bank, because there is an entity that they can go to that is very much wired into that entire regulatory surveillance framework, right? Like, to reach the effect where a bank could issue a stablecoin that would be able to move freely, I think you would need to jump that first hurdle, which is you would be able to give a bank account to someone in Lebanon, like without any identification.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddine.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures,
each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now. Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering here if online surveillance might just replace KYC, in a sense that you'll download the wallet on a phone, and then in order to have a wallet, it has to be linked to your phone number, and then that just acts as the KYC, and then you've got global surveillance. And so then it's easy for them to, if you're in Lebanon and you're suspected of being engaged in something illegal that the US government doesn't like, it's easy for them to link the wallet to the phone number and then shut you down.
Possibly. I mean, there is a very massive surveillance network and it could perform that function, but I think they would still not be willing to give that up. Like, it's too much of a mental or paradigm shift to let someone create an account without knowing who they are, right? And it might overwhelm their systems too. Like, I don't think the banks are capable of managing something like this, to be honest. But, you know, I think stablecoins are going to disappear eventually. Maybe it's 5 years, maybe it's 10 years, I don't know. I think we'll end up trading Bitcoin against something like a commodity down the road. Maybe it's Tether Gold or some other commodity-based stablecoin, not a fiat dollar stablecoin, because you're basically wrapping up some central bank note, right? And as long as you're doing that, they're going to be able to protest and put pressure to shut down. But if it's a commodity-based stablecoin like gold, then what can you do, right? It's not under your control. You could pass some law saying, you know, gold is now under control. Maybe it's like 6102 again, but you don't know. But I think it's more difficult to do. So I think eventually the dollar-based or fiat currency-based stablecoins will be phased out in favor of a commodity-based stablecoin.
That's interesting. I think the counter to that would be that they do control gold almost as much as they do control the dollar. I mean, I think about a sixth of global gold supply is held by central banks. But I think more importantly is that all the trading, all of the global trading of monetary gold takes place over a centralized blockchain platform, which is the London Bullion Market Association. And I discussed this in my new book, The Fiat Standard. You can think about it as essentially being similar to an altcoin, but there's a whole bunch of physical gold that's in London and in a few other financial centers. And once a bar is in that system, you know, once a bar goes into that system, it gets a serial number, and then it's part of that system. And then you can trade it around, you can move it around, but it has to stay within the LBMA network. And then if you actually want to cash it out, then, you know, if you take it out, then it's gone out of the system. And that's the only way that you can verify that it's an actual gold bar. So you have to take their word for it. If you want to verify it, you are out of the system and then you need to put it back in. So it's a pretty centralized, it's a very centralized system. And it's the only way that you can have a global market in gold. So you can't just, you know, if you're going to be pegging Tether to gold, if you're going to be having something like that, ultimately you need final settlement of physical gold in order to keep this moving. And it's going to have to be something far more centralized than you could do with a digital currency. So I'd be a little bit skeptical about the idea of them being able to of them letting something like that happen, because if they're going to let a gold Tether survive, it's they're more likely to let a US dollar Tether survive that they control.
It's difficult to say, but I would say Tether's already ahead of the curve, right? They already have Tether gold, and there's, I forgot how many, but there's millions of dollars worth of gold that they have in circulation already. And that's kept in Switzerland, and you can take physical possession of it. So unless there's a way to prevent taking physical possession, then I don't think it's possible to stop a commodity-based stablecoin from taking off. So you'll have the London one, but you'll also have, you know, Tether Gold or other competitors, because Tether's usually ahead of the pack when it comes to innovating these kind of financial, you know, instruments. So I see a world in which you have multiple commoditized stable coins, and they're all held in their own private vaults and with their own audits and attestations of the reserves. And, you know, there might be a large centralized one that trades purely in paper notes on a legacy system, but will also have competing systems in different jurisdictions that are backed by, you know, physical commodities.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see as the likelihood that these kind of systems are going to migrate to liquid predominantly, or maybe Lightning? You know, we'd have these stable coins built on liquid and Lightning versus, you know, being distributed over many shitcoin networks as it's currently the case.
Well, that's what I'm advocating for. So I, you know, I'm strongly trying to get more assets into liquid, because I think liquid or any liquid like federation that's using that same technology will be beneficial for, you know, society and, you know, human civilization, because we have to restore money as money and not a tool for surveillance. And I think having confidential transactions is a key part of that. And having these assets running on Lightning is also beneficial in terms of privacy and scalability. So if you have a stablecoin on Liquid, Liquid will eventually become just a plain settlement network, because right now usage is still relatively low. You can make transactions for like 10, 15 cents, right? But eventually that's going to go up as block space fills up. So you'll still need Lightning networks on top of Liquid assets. And that's what I think a number of teams are working on. But to have Liquid as kind of like the base layer for these things like a commodity stablecoin or a dollar stablecoin, and then a Lightning network on top of each one. And that will allow us to achieve planetary scale and much more improved privacy on a number of levels. Because at the base chain, you also have that privacy. And then you have the Lightning network on top of that, which also increases that privacy. So I think that is the direction we're going to go in. I don't think any of the shitcoin chains are focused on that use case or that privacy aspect, right? And most shitcoin chains are disincentivized to create second layers, because, you know, why make a second layer? Then you don't need the base layer, and you kind of reduce the value of the base layer's native token, right? So that's why nobody's working on a second layer for Solana or whatever chain, because then you don't need the SOL token, right? You could have just done it on Bitcoin at that point.
Yep, that's I think the kind of you know, the more altcoins proliferate, the more they eat into each other's market share, and then the more they obsolete each other and strengthen the case for one network, which is the only one that is neutral, the only one that is not centralized. So what do you see as the likelihood that Lightning, that Liquid will continue to grow? Do you see this as, do you see it as likely, or do you think maybe the project is stalling and that maybe it won't pick up? What do you think?
Well, I think it will continue to grow. So one of the things I will focus on next is more nation state Bitcoin adoption, potentially more Bitcoin bonds from different countries. And I will advocate for them to do those on Liquid. So it doesn't matter that specifically Liquid succeeds, but that the sidechain technology in the current form succeeds. So we could have more Liquid-like federations spring up, run by different federations in different mixes of jurisdictions. But the key is that this technology is adopted, not that Liquid Network is the only one, because then that'll be a really central point of failure.
Yeah. Okay, well, before we get to the bonds, what are the other things that Blockstream's been working on? What are other projects that they've done? So I know they do mining. They have a lot of mining infrastructure, I think, in Canada mainly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Blockstream is a Canadian company, right?
Yes, Canadian company. Yeah. There is an operation out of Quebec and also in the US, in Georgia. So I think the bulk of the mining operation is now in Georgia.
Oh, okay. Interesting. And recently you've gotten an investment from Bailey Gifford, an old Scottish money management firm, one of whom's members, I would say, or staff members is Alan Farrington, who's been on this podcast before and is a regular in our seminars. So what is that partnership? Tell us about it, this partnership with kind of old money. What is the significance of it?
I think the significance is really that it's a vote of confidence in Bitcoin as the most important technology. So Blockstream is a Bitcoin infrastructure company, and having this super old, I forgot how many years, 100-year-old Scottish company invest a significant chunk of money into Blockstream's B round kind of validates that Bitcoin is the most important chain and the only decentralized one, but also that services, products building on top of Bitcoin to extend Bitcoin are the direction to go in. And you know, a lot of the VC firms are, I would say, they're new money, right? They're looking for quick capital, quick wins, flipping companies and things like that, and just riding the hype train. But you know, if you look at Bailey Gifford, they have a long history, and they invest in things that are for the long term, right? I would say like they have a low time preference. So them investing in Blockstream kind of aligns the idea that the smart money, the long-term money, is going to go into Bitcoin, not just for investing in Bitcoin companies, but also investing in Bitcoin as an asset.
Very nice. Okay, so you're leaving Blockstream, right?
Yes.
And what are your plans moving forward?
Really just to focus on nation-state Bitcoin adoption. So with everything that happened in El Salvador, there's a lot more interest now in Bitcoin. A lot more politicians are starting to look at doing their own laws to make Bitcoin legal tender. I've been working with a senator out of Mexico, Indira Campos, to try to get something through in Mexico. But there's a number of other Latin American countries and other countries that want to do things with Bitcoin, whether it's legal tender or nation-state Bitcoin mining. So I think it's a good time for me to step away from Blockstream and focus on this new opportunity, just because you know these doors don't open all the time, right? I think everything that Blockstream is doing is incredibly important, but similar to the shift from working at an exchange to working on Bitcoin infrastructure, I just think this is the next step up for me to do something even more impactful than Bitcoin infrastructure, but getting nation states to adopt Bitcoin and to make Bitcoin even bigger.
Yes, that is, I mean, if there's a good career move, I guess, where you could take a step up from Blockstream and infrastructure, then yeah, I guess nation state adoption sounds like a good one. So what are your thoughts on El Salvador's volcano bond? I know you might not be at total freedom to tell us everything you think, but share with us what you think as much as you feel comfortable with. What do you think is the case for these bonds? What are the benefits to El Salvador? What are the benefits to investors? Before we get into that, maybe you should just give a little bit of an explanation because if some of our listeners haven't been familiar with this. So what's happening is that El Salvador, as most people will probably know, they've announced that Bitcoin is legal tender. And since then, their president, Nayib Bukele, has been extremely interested in what happens with Bitcoin. He's been very active on Bitcoin Twitter. And Max Keiser suggested to him that instead of taking on a loan from the IMF, they should mine Bitcoin with their volcanoes, because they have a lot of volcanoes in El Salvador. So they should use those volcanoes to mine Bitcoin and issue bonds against those mines. And they started with a $1 billion bond issue, right? Okay, so yeah, sorry,
I think it's either... I think Max Keiser and Alistair both came up with the idea of the bonds, and it was
Alistair
based on
Milne?
Alistair Milne. It's based off of the volcano mining meme, right? So I think that's a good way to monetize their geothermal energy. So yeah, the bond is an important part of their future, I believe. All the countries, especially in Latin America, that are, I would say, under the heel of the IMF and can only borrow to refinance debt, this is a way out for them to get capital for the development of their country with Bitcoin and with Bitcoin mining. So the only way previously would just to be continue borrowing, and the IMF would dictate and try to modify policy, or, you know, change the politicians or have some impact, right? But what this gives countries is sovereignty, right? Bitcoin gives everyone back their sovereignty, and that holds true for nation states as well. So if El Salvador pulls off this bond, then it shows the world that you don't need to rely on the IMF or any central lending institute that does not necessarily have your best interests at heart, but you can just fund everything with Bitcoin-backed bonds.
Yeah, you know, in my book, The Fiat Standard, there's a whole chapter, maybe the longest chapter in the whole book, on the development industry, which I call the misery industry. And, you know, the book looks at how fiat money works and at the protocol level, in the same way that my book, The Bitcoin Standard, looked at how Bitcoin works and then tried to understand the implications. The Fiat Standard looks at how fiat works. And the key idea is that fiat functions through, fiat is mined through lending. And lending is everything in fiat. Lending is not just borrowing. Lending is also mining in fiat system. So every time a new loan is issued by an organization that is backed by the central bank, any financial institution that is protected and regulated and backed by the central bank, if it issues a loan, it's increasing the money supply. It's making the money supply increase. And so naturally, that's what gives such an enormous incentive for everybody to get into debt. So if you look around the fiat world, individuals, municipal governments, corporations, national governments, everybody is up to their eyeballs in debt. Anybody who has any future income is borrowing against it. And we're now at a point in which the world economy is basically up to its eyeballs in debt. It can't go any more. Everybody's borrowed up to the hilt against everything that they're going to be earning into the future. And, you know, the Keynesian idea is that the more you borrow, the more growth you get. And so the Keynesians are just trying to get people to borrow more. And so they're lowering interest rates. But the capacity to continue to borrow increasingly is dwindling, just because there's a limit on how much you can borrow, which isn't the case with Bitcoin. The limit is in generating more debt for economic growth, but Bitcoin doesn't need to generate debt. Bitcoin just is equity in a sense. It just appreciates. So there's really no limit on Bitcoin's number go up, but there's a limit on how much borrowing can take place. But the interesting thing in the whole chapter that I do on the misery industry is that what the IMF and the World Bank do is they have a credit line from the U.S. Federal Reserve. So basically, they can also print money. You know, when Argentina goes to the IMF and asks for a $20 billion bailout, the IMF doesn't need to, you know, go call Brazil and South Africa and tell them, hey, give me some of the money that I lent you. I want to go lend it to Argentina. I found a better deal. They don't have a budget. They don't have a restraint on how much money they have. They're not an actual real financial institution run by adults who need to be responsible about what they do with their money. if the politics is such that Argentina should get the next $20 billion, the next $20 billion are going to be made. And it's just a credit line from the Federal Reserve. And so $20 new billion are going to be handed out. So as you can imagine, you know, this gives the IMF and the World Bank an enormous incentive to get Argentina and Brazil and all of the planet into debt, because it costs them nothing to issue those that debt. They get paid that money back, and they get it with interest. And so if you work for the IMF and you work for the World Bank, you know, your institutional interest is to hand out more debt. And that's why if you look at their, you know, what they call development economics, which pretends to be a field of knowledge when really it's just loan shark marketing material. There are all these problems in the developing countries all over the world. And the one thing they all have in common is that they can all be fixed with debt. Whatever the problem is, you know, if it's human rights or if it's poverty or if it's woman empowerment or if it's girls' education or if it's healthcare or if it's malaria, whatever it is, whatever the problem is, wherever you are in the world, Africa, Asia, Latin America, Europe, wherever you are, whatever problem it is, the answer is for you to get into debt. And there's, of course, a lot of very sophisticated literature about what the problem is and what the solution is and how we're going to spend the money and what we're going to do with the money and how we need to make sure that the money is spent with stakeholder involvement, and there needs to be participation, and there needs to be this and blah, 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 and all of the right buzzwords that you have to include. You know, it has to, all of the human rights buzzwords, all of the gender buzzwords, all of the correct now, you know, the health hypochondria buzzwords that we are adding onto that list with COVID. But, you know, all of that is details. It's like shitcoin marketing pitch. You know, yeah. What's really behind it is they want to make a new amount of money, and they want to hand out a lot of money. So it's no exaggeration to think that the IMF is a loan shark. It acts like a loan shark because it has every incentive to. And unlike loan sharks, you know, loan sharks need to actually get the money from somewhere, and they have an opportunity cost. The loan shark, if he's going to lend you $10,000 today, you know, that's $10,000 he can't lend to somebody else. But the IMF is a special kind of loan shark where it doesn't matter how many deadbeats come to it, there's always another $10,000 they can hand out, yeah. Except it's not 10,000, it's 10 billion usually. And they're always just handing it out. So I think the idea that we could just witness countries break out of that through the use of Bitcoin, it's just, it's amazing. It's one of those many amazing things that Bitcoin slaps you in the face with.
Well, that's why a lot of these organizations, and I would say powers in the world, they don't want the bonds to succeed because that breaks their entire model. You know, if you look at what the IMF is doing, they're saying, you know, El Salvador, Chivo is good, keep doing that, but you need to stop the legal tender stuff, right? Because if you no longer control the money, you lose control over everything else. So money is effectively control. Money from a nation state, like say the Canadian dollar, is a way to control the populace, right? If you have the protests in Canada and you freeze people's accounts, you can effectively control them, right? It's a more PC way to kill somebody. You kill them financially, stop them from eating, ruin their finances, get them evicted, whatever, right? You didn't put a gun to their head and shoot them, but you've effectively killed them. Or in the winter in Canada, you might actually do that if you starve them out and they have no recourse. But at a nation state level, it's the same thing. If you can keep them in debt, if you're the one that's providing them with quote unquote money, then they have to listen to you. It's a way to control, just like controlling your own population, but now you're controlling another nation state. And that just is an erosion of sovereignty, right? You're no longer a sovereign nation if you're at the beck and call of one of these, you know, unelected, you know, clown organizations that have no responsibility or even ethics, right? And everything is corrupt. The whole network is corrupt, right? So you have the rating agencies that are downgrading old debt from these states, which makes it more expensive for them, right? Because now they're paying a higher coupon than is the face value of the debt. So they need to borrow more money in the future. So it's just a downward spiral that you can't really get out of. And Bitcoin is the only way out of that hole. So I think a lot is riding on the success of the model behind backing a nation state with Bitcoin. And I think Bitcoin mining is an important thing too. So I think President Bukele was very smart that he decided to go with the volcano bonds, right? It's not just that it's a funny meme and you're mining with volcano, but energy independence is also very key. So not only do you need to have Bitcoin, you need to have energy as well. And the best example, like there's so many great examples that are coming out in the last month, you know, of why Bitcoin, right? It's almost like the world is kind of realigning itself to show, look at this thing, look at Bitcoin. It's so important. You need to look at this, right? So Germany wants to sanction Russia, but they can't because they rely on Russia for energy because their own nutheads shut down all their nuclear plants. So they're energy dependent, right? So energy independence is just like another thing that you suddenly realize you need to have. And energy and Bitcoin are deeply intertwined. If you have energy, you can get Bitcoin. You can get Bitcoin without relying on anybody else. You can't be cut off from any network, right? And your energy won't be cut off as well. So with El Salvador having the Bitcoin law, Bitcoin legal tender, with Bitcoin bonds and with mining, they're set up to be a real sovereign nation, an actual real sovereign nation out of the control of the IMF and World Bank.
Yes, I think that's absolutely fascinating. And you know, these rating agencies you mentioned, they're going on about how El Salvador is being irresponsible. What's truly amazing for me is how they don't think and they don't mention that borrowing from the IMF is actually what's really irresponsible, because you know, not only is the IMF does the IMF have the ability to just make money out of thin air, the IMF is not accountable to anybody. The IMF and the World Bank, I think this is a very, very important point that is blatantly obvious, but it's one of those very obvious things which people don't like to think about or don't like to mention, and whose implications are not understood. So what does it mean that there's nobody that the World Bank reports to, and there's nobody that the IMF reports to? There is no boss for the head of the IMF to report to. The IMF and the World Bank have their own internal assessment departments. Those are the only people they report to. So basically it's a self-licking ice cream cone, as lots of things are in fiat, in that the IMF hands out tens of billions of dollars to these deadbeat governments that go and then use it in all kinds of horrific things. And then, you know, nobody is going to go to the IMF and say, hey, why did you give this deadbeat $10 billion that he then used to genocide his ethnic minorities and make himself leader for life and make his family and his tribe rule the country for a century? Why did you give this guy $10 billion? There's nobody outside the IMF who can ask them that question. They don't have to answer that question to anybody. If you're a journalist, you try and ask them that question, you don't get to ask them any more questions. That's it. If you're a government that wants to ask them that question, you don't get to ask them any more questions. They have their money. They have their funding. You know, they can pay lip service to Congress. They can turn up against up at Congress and, you know, say that we're doing our best and we're going to fix all of the problems. But it doesn't matter. It's completely... it's just noises. It's irrelevant because there's no real accountability. Nobody's going to get fired in the IMF because they gave too much loans to a corrupt government. Nobody's going to lose their job. Nobody's going to have to pay from their own pocket. There is no accountability. There's only an internal body in the IMF, which is hired by the IMF, paid by the IMF, career people whose career depends on the IMF. They're the ones who write the reports assessing the success of IMF programs. And guess what? They're always successful. Yeah, I mean, there's always, obviously, you can learn from it, but of course, it's always, and the problem is, you know, this is the kind of the conclusion they always come up with is this saying, which is so frequent and so common in the misery industry, this idea that you can take the horse to the water, but you can't force the horse to drink. And it's just, well, you know, we did our best. We told those, and this is where like the colonial language begins to show up. Like, we told those, you know, nasty third worlders, here's how you build a modern government. We gave them all the money. We told them how to do it. but they just didn't want to do it. The president was corrupt. This or that or the other thing got in the way. We had cultural barriers. You know, basically, those are third worlders and they can't function. As if this kind of dynamic could work anywhere. You know, you could go to any society anywhere. It doesn't matter whether it's a first or third world or anything, anywhere in the world, and you find a guy and you give him billions of dollars and you tell him, here, you know, you can centrally plan your entire economy. That's not going to work anywhere. You could destroy any country in the world by doing that to it. But of course, they never introspect. They never look at themselves. And it's always the fault of, you know, it's always the fault of the people that are taking that money. It's never the fault of the people that give them that money. Bitcoin, of course, fixes this, because when, you know, when a president issues bonds backed by Bitcoin mining, he doesn't have any fallback option. There is no central bank for Bitcoin that can bail him out. So if he messes up, he's going to have to pay the price, and then he's going to have to face his angry people. There is no getting out of that by just going to the IMF and the World Bank to bail you out. Yep. So if anything, it is far more responsible. But as you said, you know, these rating agencies and the media, they're all in the same fiat. Yeah, they're all eating at the same trough of fiat money, and they all benefit from it. So what is the case then for the Bitcoin bonds for an investor? This has been unclear so far, but has it been decided whether this is going to grant you citizenship or residency in El Salvador if you invest in those bonds?
I believe yes. The president did say that that would be the case. Any investment would lead up to citizenship fast tracking, but I believe they haven't created the new laws that would enable it yet, but there is a raft of laws going to Congress soon, which will include the new digital securities laws, which will enable the bond issuance. So I think we'll get clarity on that in the coming weeks, but right now it's still TBD.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. All right, so I want to go back to the block size war. You were pretty high profile in the block size war, and it wasn't just because you made the famous hats, although that, I think, was enormously influential. It helped enormously. Speaking of which, you scammed me out of a signed copy of the Bitcoin Standard by sending me a bunch of hats, and then after I got the hats, I realized, hang on a second, I never wear hats. So you got a Bitcoin Standard copy from me without me really getting anything out of it, but you know, well played. The hats are pretty cool. So
well, you could
that.
Wear a hat one day if you need it, a hat. It's really sunny outside or something.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. So tell us a little bit more. And there's a book that was published by BitMEX Research, Jonathan Beer from BitMEX Research. The book's called The Block Size War, which does a good job of documenting the events of this war. Can you tell us a little bit about your role and the just the war itself, what happened, what you think went down, how likely you think it was that this would be the outcome? Do you think it was just destined that the small blockers would win, or do you think there was a real risk that the big blockers would win?
I think long term, the small block camp would have won. It's just a question of how nasty that war would have been, because you can't really change Bitcoin, right? You might end up with a lot of hash rate potentially going with bigger blocks, but the small blockchain would still continue. And, you know, it's a slippery slope. And that's why we preferred we didn't go down that route. And that's why we advocated strongly for the small blocks, because if there was a split and there was a big block blockchain, which technically there was, right? I mean, it did happen. It's called Bcash, or whatever they called it. I think they rebranded it now, right? But they have their big blocks, but they can, once they set that precedent that they can change whatever they want, they can keep changing whatever they want, right? So it would have died eventually. But I think the outcome was the ideal outcome, which was game theory all worked out. Nobody was willing to make the first move and, you know, try to affect change and modify the protocol. And everything I think, worked out pretty good, right? It was better that we did that war when Bitcoin was about $1,000 than right now when it's, what is it now, 40-something thousand dollars. It's better to have gotten through that phase in Bitcoin's growing pains, come out on the other side unscathed, and set the example that you cannot modify Bitcoin. And I think the Ethereum hard fork also had a place in that, right? Showing that, you know, you can modify it, but then what's the point? Because if you can modify the chain and change the rule set, then anything goes and there's no point to it anymore, right? So I think it was the right move. And I think I like to think I contributed to winning that war. Aaron Van Wordham says I was the only C-level executive at that time that was standing up and supporting the small block camp. Because if you remember back then, it was every single Bitcoin company out there saying we want bigger blocks, you know, Brian Armstrong leading the charge. And now you see he's an ETH head, you know, it's brianarmstrong.eth. So he kind of naturally selected away everyone else and got them out of Bitcoin because they're not Bitcoiners, right? And they have no connection to the Bitcoin ethos whatsoever. And I think we have a much healthier ecosystem now because of that. And I remember when your book came out, I think it was just after the wars had kind of subsided. And I thought, wow, it's good. Someone actually wrote something. And now there's a body of material that we can look at and see why it's important to have Bitcoin as Bitcoin is right now. Because back then, there was not a lot of material. I think a lot of material came after the war. But if that existed before, it would have been great, right? And I think Johnny Beer's book is good too, right? Documenting that history so that we don't need to go back and relive that in the future.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you talk about the Bitcoin ethos, I think this was the fire that forged that ethos. And it was forged really, as you said, by just everybody who doesn't agree with it rage quitting and going into their own shitcoin. And I think it's before then, we could say Bitcoin was immutable, but it wasn't very clear that that was the case. And it was, I think somebody like Gavin Andreessen, who was probably the face of Bitcoin up until 2016. I remember, I think it was in 2013 or so, that the Financial Times had written something along the lines of, or maybe The Economist, one of these fiat publications, had said that Gavin Andreessen was more important to Bitcoin than Satoshi, and that he's the face of Bitcoin. And Gavin Andreessen was pretty clear from 2014 or so that Bitcoin needs to have its blocks increased, we need to hard fork, and that's just going to be straightforward. And there was even, you know, he had some posts and some emails in which he spoke, you know, I'm sick of waiting for people to come along. I'm just going to use my prerogative as, can't remember what it was, but, you know, something along the lines of, if you guys won't just come along, I'm just going to do it myself, and then you're going to have to join. I think a lot of people did not understand the immutability of Bitcoin as it is, and I think they thought that they could change it. And, you know, it's difficult to tell in retrospect how likely they could have gotten to changing it. But I think this war and the way that it went, I think, was enormously influential in just driving this point home, that you can't change Bitcoin, you can only leave it. And I think it was you who made the metaphor once about this is like a train that's heading out there and you're trying to change direction by jumping off the train. I think it was you who made that at some point.
Maybe. I've said a lot of things.
Yes. Yeah, but I think it's an excellent metaphor, because Bitcoin is just the current consensus parameters are just headed in a certain direction. And if you want to change them, then, you know, jump from the train and see if that changes the direction of the train. It doesn't. It's just going to leave you in a bloody puddle on the road, and the train is going to keep going, and people are going to forget about you after a couple.
The danger back then was a lot of people didn't know that, though, right? And it's about educating them. And I think a lot of people forget how new Bitcoin was still back then. It's still new, and there's still a lot of people that have no clue what Bitcoin is, even though they've been in the space. But back then, it was much worse, I think. And
yeah,
it was to the point where somebody like Bitmain and Jihan Wu could say, you know, we are the miners, and we are going to do this. and sucks to be you, right? Because we are in control of the protocol, and that's not the case. So getting over that hurdle was one big thing. But I would say back then it was so early that nobody really knew how mining worked, really, right? I think nowadays people have a much better understanding of mining and mining pools and everything like that, and the whole dynamic of, you know, buying the ASIC, hosting the ASIC, pooling the mining, and then, you know, getting Bitcoin. But back then, like, Jihan could stand up there and represent that, you know, we have 30% or 40, maybe 40 with both his pools of hash rate, and we can do this. But people don't understand that he is just bluffing, because that hash rate is not his. It's his customer's hash rate, which he may or may not be hosting that, right? So it was just educating people very quickly about how things actually are and calling out bullshit when there is bullshit, right? And I think if nobody did anything back then maybe they could have changed it, right? Because everything was against Bitcoin. You have Coinbase, you have blockchain info. Like, a lot of these guys are less relevant today than they were back then, right? Yeah. But back then it was just like going up against this massive conglomerate of every single Bitcoin company, almost, with like a handful that were not party to that, right?
Yeah. Worth mentioning BitMEX, where BitMEX were on the good side of this one. One of the few big Bitcoin companies that made a difference, I think, in sticking out. But yeah, I think, you know, 2017, you know, Bitcoin was 2.5% of where it is right now. So 1,000 versus 40,000. And, you know, the vast majority of, so imagine every company is a 40th of this, or the entire industry is a 40th of where it is. And then all the companies that were there around then, all the big ones, all the big miners, all the big exchanges, they were all on board with this. And I mean, I remember, for instance, for some of my friends, you know, some of my outside of Bitcoin friends who would follow me on Twitter at that time, they'd try and keep up with the drama. And to them, it just sounded insane. Like, all of these Bitcoin companies and all of the famous Bitcoiners, you have Roger Ver, you have Gavin Andreessen, and you have all of the people that are on the media about Bitcoin going on about, hey, we're going to upgrade Bitcoin. And then we have this random, you know, this random university professor in Lebanon and a bunch of his friends online, many of whom, you know, have cat profile pictures or whatever. And they're just standing there and saying, no, screw you. You're not going to get away with it. And it just seems so absurd that, you know, clearly you guys have no idea what you're doing. It's a little bit like, you know, it looked to an extent as if it's, you know, it's McDonald's customers thinking that they can stop McDonald's from introducing a new menu item. Like, you just can't do it. Sure, you like the current sandwich, but they're going to make a new sandwich, and the CEO knows better than you. And, you know, you don't have an executive vote on the board of McDonald's. What are you going to be doing? But we did. We you know, randos shitposting on Twitter managed to get Bitcoin to stay as it is. And I think it's a remarkable episode. I got really, personally, on a personal level, I got very lucky that was the time that I wrote my book. And my book was pretty much ready for publication around June 2017. But I had a publisher, and the publisher needed time to go over it. And so it took several months to get it. And then I had to, you know, I still had time to revise it, and I submit the final version of the book in January 2018. So during those months, I got lucky. In a sense, I got very unlucky that the book was published in early 2018 rather than early 2017, because Bitcoin was much cheaper in 2017 than in 2018. So I could have stacked a lot more sats.
Yes.
But it was maybe it wasn't a price worth paying, but there was a silver lining to it, which was the fact that by being late, I could write about the block size war in the book. And it was really the glue that got all of the book together, because the whole book was all about Bitcoin's money supply. And the obvious question is, well, it's just code, people can change it. And no matter how much you try and explain that it can't be changed, it's not going to drive the lesson home as much as saying, look, you know, we just had this whole massive attempt to change Bitcoin where all of those people tried, and all they were trying to do is, it wasn't even changing the monetary policy. They're just trying to change the size of the blocks, and it failed.
Yeah, it was a very innocuous change, right? Which made it dangerous. Yeah. And it's like, it's such an innocuous change that people outside our circles or, you know, in the media might say, oh, these guys are unreasonable. Those guys, they're nice businesses and all they want to do is go from one to two, right? And make it cheaper for people. It's a very nice messaging, but you get into that slippery slope. Then you get some idiot that might say, 21 is not enough. 21 million is not enough for everyone to have one Bitcoin. We should have, you know, 210 million Bitcoin so that everyone in the world has a better chance of getting a Bitcoin. But it's just these glad-handing, nice-sounding, platitude-type people that bring the world into ruin, right? The same thing with nuclear energy. Like, yeah, nuclear is so bad. We should use the power of the wind and the sun and not have to do nasty things like, you know, split atoms, right? And there's like nuclear waste here. But you ignore all the other costs, like, you know, how much lithium do you need for batteries for solar? How do you get rid of the wind blades that don't degrade over time? You just bury them, you know? It's just the same thing. It's like a common theme between the block size wars and what's happening with energy and the push for energy austerity. It sounds nice on the outside, but people lack critical thinking skills, right? And they just go with whatever sounds nice. And that really bites them in the ass, which we're seeing again and again and again and again today, which is good for Bitcoin, right? But yeah, like having your book out earlier would have been great, a great tool in that war. But I think we managed to pull it off, the ragtag band.
Yes, all because of the hats.
Yes.
I'll add to you, to what you said. I think if in 2014, 15, 16, 17, if I was tasked by somebody to try and take out Bitcoin and destroy it, or at least tame it and make it innocuous, I think the block size would have been the best angle of attack, because everybody wants to scale. Everybody wants number of transactions to go up. Everybody wants more people to get on Bitcoin. It's an extremely compelling case. You know, 1 megabyte isn't going to cut it. What's the harm in just having 2 megabytes? Like, you're going to double the throughput. You can get more transactions. More children in Africa will be able to clear their transactions on the blockchain. It just sounds so nice and so well-intentioned that you could drive a wedge in Bitcoin with that. You could get a significant amount of Bitcoiners to want to support it. And then once you've popped that cherry of immutability for one thing, then of course it's just a matter of time before you do all the rest of them. So, I mean, I'm not saying that there were nefarious elements pushing this, but I'm saying if there were nefarious elements, this is what they would have been doing.
Definitely. And they had the power to do it. I just think they could have probably pulled it off. If I was fighting for the big block side, I think I could have made it happen, because they controlled so many different parts of the ecosystem that they could have just said, this is the new Bitcoin, right? They had the block explorers, right? They could have made BCH BTC, right? The exchanges could have changed the listing too. It would have caused a massive amount of confusion and damage. Maybe it would take 10 years to recover from, but you know, they could have done something really bad. And that's why at Blockstream, one of the projects I pushed along a lot was the Blockstream Info Explorer. Now you have mempool, but the ecosystem is much healthier than back in the day. Because if you look back then, like, what were the main explorers that most average people use to determine Bitcoin transactions? It's Blockchain Info. I think there was Blockchair, which was a Bcash one. I don't know. I think they might have changed it, but I think there's another one from someone else too. Oh, BTC.com, which is also Bitmain, right? So they had like every single resource at their disposal to really say, this is Bitcoin, not that one, not the decentralized immutable one. But I think the game theory prevailed. They chickened out at the last minute because they knew if they go all in, they would have probably failed in the long run. And with Bcash, you see that, like, Bcash is everything they wanted. And it's useless now. No one cares about it. I don't even talk about it anymore because it's so useless.
Yeah, I think at this point, both Bcash and BSV, which was the fork of Bcash, BSV was like the reductio ad absurdum of Bcash. You know, if you're going to fork, and if you're going to fork because Roger Ver wants bigger blocks, then you're just going to get another another guy who's more of a Roger Ver than Roger Ver, and he's going to want to fork for other even stupider reasons, and then you're going to end up with BSV, which I think, you know, is like the pinnacle of blockchain failure. Both of them today are worth less than 1% of Bitcoin, maybe a little bit more than 1%, but roughly they're the two of them are the two of them are less than 1% of Bitcoin. It's just complete insignificance. And I think it's such a powerful illustration of, it's not about the block size, it's not about the throughput, it's not about the on-chain capacity, it's about the immutability. That's why Bitcoin matters.
Yep. Exactly.
All right. Stefano has a question. Stefano, about privacy and anonymity.
Yes. Thank you, Saif. And thank you, Samson. It was very interesting to hear your perspective. So my question is the following. As you learn more about Bitcoin, and I'm relatively new to this, maybe 6-7 months, you realize that contrary to what you hear initially, Bitcoin is not really private. Together with the KYC and the public blockchain, all transactions are really public and they are there forever. Therefore, privacy is really not one of the features of the Bitcoin network, at least the way it works at the fundamental level. But we realized in the last few months how privacy is important in all aspects of financial transactions. So do you think this is a major flaw of the Bitcoin network? And how do you see this privacy and anonymity issue being addressed? You mentioned a little bit that in the context of the Liquid network. I'm interested if you can expand on this a bit more.
Right. So it's difficult. It's a difficult topic. It's a very complex one. So in theory, every Bitcoin transaction should be anonymous. Like, you're making an assumption that coins are being sent to someone from someone else, right? But in theory, any new UTXO should be a clean coin, right? Mm-hmm. Because a transaction was made. But I guess we're applying a lot of our baggage on how we look at Bitcoin. And we do make those links and say, this is from someone else. And this is from some exchange to some guy. And then that guy sent it to this guy, right? Because you can see all that stuff. But in theory, every new UTXO should be a fresh origin point. And that should be ideally the way that Bitcoin is looked at. And Bitcoin can be quite anonymous if it's used correctly. But if you're withdrawing from an exchange or some place where you're identified, of course, that breaks that whole model. But when you have peer-to-peer trading, if you're trading on a decentralized exchange like BISC or something, then I think it's quite privacy preserving. And you should not need to worry too much about it. And if you can go from decentralized exchange to a Lightning transaction, I think you have pretty good levels of privacy protection. But in the state that we are at today, I think having something like Liquid and Lightning is definitely important, because normal, ordinary people, like less technical people, are not going to be able to figure out how to use Bitcoin properly. They're just going to buy it on an exchange, and maybe they don't even take it off exchange. Maybe they spend from exchange. So you do see that sometimes, like someone is paying an invoice and they're paying from their Binance wallet or something like that. And, you know, they're using Bitcoin in a very odd way, but it's what could be expected from a new user. But having something like Liquid, if you withdraw to a Liquid wallet, then you automatically have privacy, right? And if you can withdraw off an exchange to Lightning, then you also have that privacy. So I would say these technologies are more about evening out the playing field for new users or less experienced users. But, you know, Bitcoin itself is decently private if you are smart enough to use it in a certain way. But I think the important thing is that more people are getting more privacy benefits out of it than, you know, than trying to optimize the base layer.
Okay, thank you, Samos. Very quick follow-up. How do you get non-KYC coins in the United States? Because that's really how most people acquire coins, right? Are you suggesting that we should not use a centralized exchange to buy them in the first place?
Well, if you buy coins from someone else, then they're not KYC coins. But they could be said that it's that guy, right? So it's a really tricky market, the way that everything works right now. And I think it's less than ideal.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Samson. Appreciate the thoughts.
Ulf, you have a question on the block size war?
Well, I can really try to figure it out. Samson, you talked about block size war and about the big blocks and the small blocks. What's your opinion if something happens like another fork, like proof of work blockchain, BTC, versus a proof of stake blockchain like Bitcoin Green? What's your opinion? Is this a possible outcome which may come in the future? And what's your opinion on this? Will this have a chance, or will this be overrode like the train which goes right straight to hell, or whatever what we expect of Bitcoin?
So the question is, can we change Bitcoin to proof of stake, or you're asking about proof of stake in general?
No, the probability that there will be a stake or Bitcoin Green, and then what may happen in the future.
Right. Well, the first thing we should talk about is that proof of stake is perpetual energy. So I don't think proof of stake, there's a lot of problems with proof of stake, why it cannot work. And if you fix one of the problems, you create another problem. So the general trend is for proof of stake proponents to create a very, very complex system so that the flaws cannot be easily identified. But I don't think Bitcoin could be changed to proof of stake. And if you really wanted to say you have proof of stake Bitcoin, you could say the Lightning Network is proof of stake, right? And that is green. So you have Lightning, you have Bitcoin in Lightning if you prove that you have Bitcoin on the main chain. So that's effectively proof of stake, right?
Okay, great. Thanks for the answer.
Yeah, it's proof of stake, but it can scale. That's the difference. And it's secure.
The problem is, like, proof of stake systems, it's always someone's got to create the stake to sell, right? And that whole process cannot be fair. So in the case of, like, say, Ethereum, they're going to make a big piece of the pie and pre-sell to insiders. And then the stake is, the large portion of the stake is largely controlled by a few entities, right? They may try to obscure it because they tried to get people to make multiple accounts for the sale, but it's still controlled by a small group of insiders, which is basically the fiat system. And that's not what we're here for. So proof of stake is really just the fiat system, but with a blockchain and some waste.
Yeah, it's the fiat system, but without a without a military to force you to use the token. And this is, I think, why it's ultimately doomed, because it's only good for the insiders, and you can't get the outsiders to join in unless you put a gun to their head, which is how the current fiat system works. So I can't see it being successful in the long run, except in the short run, to basically promote shitcoin scams, as is the case. All right, Peter.
Hi, Samson. I wanted to ask a question about the issuance of securities on the Liquid network. You made a very eloquent case earlier in the conversation that there can be an advantage in trading one-to-one equivalents of Bitcoin on the Liquid network, because this can increase transaction speed and also privacy. But I wanted to ask specifically about the use case of securities. You mentioned that when you have a security, you still need to have an oracle or a centralized party to issue a pay or not pay signal. So given this, why don't you just have the company that is issuing the security sell the token on some kind of centralized service? Why is there an advantage in using a blockchain for this at all?
Well, I think one of them is atomic swaps. So if you have a number of assets in the Liquid network, then you can perform an atomic swap. You could swap that asset for LBTC, for any stablecoin, or another asset, and there is no need to have any counterparty risk. There's no need to trust the other party. So I think one of the interesting things out there is this app called Sideswap, which is basically promoting atomic swaps on the Liquid network. So at the end of the day, the whole point of having a blockchain at any point is to facilitate liquidity and freedom of movement and trade. And that goes for securities, for stablecoins, or really anything. So it's the seamless trading 24/7, the ability to trade peer-to-peer without an intermediary, and the reduced need for counterparty risk so that no one will scam you in the trade.
Yes, you guys were talking about centralization, decentralization, and I've convinced myself, plus Safedean's beat me up pretty hard about being able to decentralize something physical, like the on-off ramps to Bitcoin. And when you understand that, you start thinking about it a little differently. But I heard Jack Dorsey the other day made a comment about social media would have looked a lot different had it grown up under Bitcoin. And he didn't go any further, but I've heard him hint several times, and I think that's of great interest to him. At least I hope it is. I've watched things like Steemit, where they've tried to use coins and cost and value comments and all that kind of stuff. And it really looks pretty corny when you see it. My question is, what do you have any general thoughts? You're talking about promoting to sovereign countries. And I'm waiting for the deluge of poor old El Salvador's too stupid to get up in the morning and think for themselves. What do you have any general thoughts about that and how things like Lightning and maybe to a lesser extent in that area, Liquid and Bitcoin might impact that? I also think, one last comment before you answer, I agree with Safedean that George Gilner is not a representative of the libertarian community, but he does use libertarian tools to make some pretty good arguments. Maybe I'm just being hopeful. So I'm wondering about your thoughts.
Well, okay, there's a couple of questions packed in there. So I guess we can start from the first one. So I think decentralizing social media platforms is a noble effort. I haven't really thought too much about how to do it, because there's always the question of moderation. I think you'd have to have something like the ability to run a full node of whatever platform you're using, right? Otherwise, it just becomes centralized once again. And I don't know if people are willing to do that, because it's a lot of work, right, to run a node and to run an independent piece of software that would serve things up. So I guess I will let Jack Dorsey keep working on that, but it's not something I'm really focused on. I mean, we have things that are better than Twitter, like we have Mastodon and other things like that. Adoption is not quite there, I think, just because there's a massive amount of network effect. So whatever new thing comes out, it needs to have some orders of magnitude better user experience than everything else. And having it be decentralized, I think, is a challenge for that, just because, you know, people don't want to run something. They just want to download something and have access right away. So the challenge is balancing that user experience with the actual decentralization. The other question was about more nation states adopting Bitcoin, right?
Yes.
So most people are followers, and I believe it's the same case for nation states. I think a number are already working on it, but I think the vast majority are probably waiting for El Salvador to see something good come out of what they've done so far, and then they will make the case. But, you know, nation states are typically not innovators. We have a really rare opportunity, and just a rarity in El Salvador, which is President Nayib Bukele is a forward-thinking individual with a lot of guts to do something, right? And we just have to wait and see how it plays out with everyone else. But I know that there are a number of others, at least politicians in other nation states, working on this. So it's just a matter of time. I think we just lucked out that El Salvador was able to move so quickly. And I think that's not the norm. And it's an outlier. All right, was there another part of the question? I can't remember. There's a couple things bundled up in there, right?
No, you covered it. Other than, do you see social media playing a role in these? I noticed Bukele in El Salvador is really, he's kind of used it to his advantage. He's savvy. I can see where others would really get in trouble politically, social, just maybe not be as adept at it as him. Do you see that as part of the adoption process? In other words, is there a plan? Well, when I get up in the morning and look at the various news feeds, they're all the same. You can tell they originated at the same place. Government entities are using that masterfully. I wonder if there's some guerrilla warfare on the other side.
Well, all the media in all forms does have a hand in everything, but it's going to be up to who is more clever and who uses it more novelly, right? So I think President Bukele is great at social media, and he's able to leverage that to his advantage and build up a large following. And I think in the long run, that's going to help El Salvador, because, you know, it's much harder to quell or to hammer in that nail that's sticking out if everyone's watching that nail. That's also why in Canada, I was suggesting, I think I was talking to NVK, Rodolfo, and we're discussing Pierre Poilievre's aim for going for a prime minister. And I said he should take the same strategy, get international support, galvanize the international group of Bitcoiners, and try to leverage that into something that he can use in Canada. Because I think it's difficult to just work within a single country, especially one that's as backwards as Canada.
All right, Boris.
Hi, Samson. Thank you so much for joining us. I was wondering, how do you envision the bonds and stocks and other assets on Liquid blockchain? Are they going to be also tagged with KYC AML information? Because right now, as I see it, it's pretty much bearer instruments, and those are being pushed out by the fiat governments, and they don't want to see these instruments. They always want to have them KYC and AML then attached to identities. Thank you.
So with all securities on Liquid, current securities, they are going to be KYC'd, and, you know, it is whitelisted. I don't think we're at the stage yet where you can have a security that is 100% bearer, but these things are bearer-like. So as long as you're on the whitelist, then you can trade it with anyone else on the whitelist, and there's nobody that can stop that process. So I think, you know, Bitcoin is the only real bearer asset, but it's also good to have other securities, like stock-like assets or security tokens or bonds that are traded in a similar way. But, you know, as long as you have Bitcoin, which is permissionless, decentralized, and accessible to anyone, then as long that it makes it better, even though we can't go to full bearer securities.
Thank you.
Welcome.
All right, well, yeah. Samson, thank you so much for this. This has been extremely informative and entertaining. It's been a pleasure reminiscing about the old our old days in the service of Bitcoin, like veterans in a war. And best of luck on getting all of these Latin American countries orange pilled and all of your post Blockstream adventures. I'm sure Blockstream will miss you, but I believe Latin America will enjoy you and your hopefully. Contribution to their cause. I hope so. Yes. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on, Saif. It's been great.
Cheers. Bye-bye.